Support for AHLA and the following message comes from Healthcare Appraisers, fair market valuation experts. As a pioneer in its field, Healthcare Appraisers has valued tens of thousands of healthcare transactions, allowing it to gain an in-depth and unparalleled understanding of the healthcare industry amidst an ever-changing landscape of regulatory oversight. For more information, visit healthcareappraisers.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, What Counsel Are Asking About and Need to Know to Prepare for Patient Surges, Provider Staffing. This is one in a series of podcasts that focuses on legal and operational questions for providers during the COVID-19 emergency. I'm Andrea Ferrari, a partner at Healthcare Appraisers, and we're proud to be providing financial support for this podcast. The podcast is part of a series and a project of the AHLA Public Health Systems Affinity Group, which is a group that I chair. And the series is focusing on various novel and important questions that we're going to be dealing with over the next few months due to the conditions created by the COVID-19 emergency. These are questions that may define how and how well we as a society manage and maintain public health and safety through this unprecedented time. Given this backdrop, I wanted to thank AHLA for providing a forum to discuss what I think are really important issues. And I want to thank the panelists for this program for taking time out in this exceptionally busy time for them to share their thoughts and observations for the benefit of others. I would probably also be remiss if I did not also thank my wonderful colleagues at Healthcare Appraisers who have shared many examples of analysis they're seeing and solutions that they've offered in order to inform this discussion. I'm going to give a special shout out to my colleague, Luis Argueso, who's been modeling hazard pay premiums and helping so many of our clients find solutions for the better part of 2 weeks, and he's been very busy. I want to take a minute to introduce our panelists. We have with us today Tom Donahoe, who's Vice President and Deputy General Counsel of SCL Health, a nonprofit faith-based health system serving various Western states, including Colorado, Kansas, Wyoming, and Montana. In his role, Tom provides primary legal support and advice on system-wide transactions and a variety of legal issues. We also have Joe Wolf, a shareholder at Hall Render, whose specialty is navigating legal issues related to physician compensation. During this pandemic, much of Joe's work has been focused on helping hospitals and health systems to develop contracting and compensation strategies that support COVID-19 coverage, including the redeployment of specialty providers and the development of new and modified arrangements to address excess capacity and potential immediate and long-term needs. This podcast is one of two parts. The first part that we are covering today is going to focus on common questions and issues related to meeting provider staffing needs and addressing staff shortages and related concerns. And these questions and issues are in four categories: incremental staffing, provider redeployment, provider standby availability, and provider income protection. The second part will focus on space supplies and equipment needs and common legal and operational questions related to addressing concerns about matching needs and demands in those areas. Although I've introduced this program, we're going to take turns being the interviewer and interviewees, and I think Tom wants to be the first to ask the question, so I'm going to turn things over to him.
Great. Thanks, Andrea. And it's a pleasure to be on this podcast. Obviously, an important time for our organization, and I know a number of the clients you serve. And it may just be worth taking a couple of seconds here before we get into the first topic here to talk about what a surge even is. I think a lot of folks are hearing that term around the country, and the reality is a number of different states and different locations are in different phases of what we characterize as a surge, and that's really an influx of patients due to COVID-19. And then as those patients come in, how do healthcare facilities really flex their space and their resources to accommodate those patient surges? And I think we've all been watching the media to some degree and seen the different curves and everything and how those surges could potentially occur and whether they may be significant based on social distancing and other standards, or if they could be more flat, which I think we're all hoping to accomplish. But in any event, I think, again, our organization and a lot of your clients and Joe's clients are probably preparing for not necessarily the worst case, but obviously significant situations where they can hopefully accommodate patient need. And really the focus of this segment was on that provider staffing piece. It's one element of what I would characterize as surge planning, but an important element. Providers are a finite resource, I think, to begin with, and in a pandemic, become an even more valuable resource. And I think you've bucketed fairly well the nature of kind of the provider staffing arrangements we're seeing come into play as part of these surges. And I'll just repeat them for a second. I think they're fourfold that we'll talk about: are kind of incremental staffing arrangements, provider redeployment, provider standby availability, where maybe that resource isn't needed immediately, but maybe needed eventually. And then finally, arrangements where you are addressing provider lost income as a result of maybe the loss of elective procedures as part of a state federal mandate or otherwise, and how you're accounting for that. So as we head into that, I'll throw the first question out to either you or Joe to maybe talk a little bit about, you know, can you provide an example of what an incremental staffing arrangement may look like to accommodate a patient surge? And then what types of questions you're receiving and maybe the challenges that your clients are finding with respect to these types of arrangements?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. This is, again, Joe Wolf from Hall Render, and I echo Andrea and Tom's comments before about how it's a privilege to be able to participate in this and try to help organizations as they work through this very challenging environment. As Tom teed up, we're speaking about a few concepts here, and the first one here is incremental staffing arrangements. I think we are borrowing some of the concepts that we've seen historically in physician arrangements, and typically when we're talking about an incremental staffing arrangement, we're talking about some type of arrangement that captures incremental or additional work effort. And we are seeing the development of incremental staffing arrangements where clinicians are being asked to do more. And as Tom mentioned earlier, across the country, as different organizations are responding to different levels of need right now, they're asking for their clinicians to do more. And I think they're either clinically or administratively right now. We're seeing situations where clinicians that are under an existing employment agreement are being asked to take on and perform extra additional services, many than was originally included in the original contract. From a legal and contracting standpoint, that might entail an amendment or an addendum to the existing agreement. We're seeing that with many types of providers or clinicians, not only physicians, but advanced practice clinicians and other types of clinicians at other levels, including nurses and other types of care providers. With respect to developing this kind of incremental or additional capacity beyond clinicians that already have arrangements, we're seeing the development of clinician pools that can be accessed as needed. I think we'll talk about that a bit later in the standby arrangements as well, but having contracts in place with providers that can be scaled up as necessary to meet the need will become, I think, more important. And that involves not only engaging the clinicians, but also the scheduling dynamic. And we have to think about, you know, how to structure those arrangements. Do we do them as employed or as independent contractor arrangements? There's questions about documentation. We've helped organizations develop very short template documents, 2 pages or less, that really lay out the bare bone concepts of what that arrangement entails. When the arrangement would start, is it immediate or is the provider on standby until they're ultimately needed? When will the arrangement terminate? You know, is that going to be driven by the conclusion of the national emergency? Is that on 5 days' notice? There's a few different ways you can approach that. How scheduling is going to be going to work, we're seeing them developed where it's mutually agreed upon. And then there's some contemplation of how staffing would surge up based on what the organization's doing internally. There's a lot of questions that emerge around the clinician's obligations when activated and scheduled. If the clinician is already working for the organization, that may not be as challenging. They likely already have medical staff membership, may have privileges, likely have privileges already, and may already be falling in line with the policies and procedures. But for other clinicians that are going to come online, they may need to obtain that medical staff membership. They may need to get accelerated privileges. We may see clinicians that have to have expanded privileges. So it's helpful to capture at least some of that in a very short contract. You may need to develop policies and procedures to react. Also, in these types of arrangements, you need to be thinking about the payment for the services and the necessary documentation. We're seeing many organizations develop an hourly rate approach. Perhaps if the clinician's an independent contractor, there'd be some type of invoicing process. Hopefully there has to be developments, the development of a defensibility strategy. Down the line, if you need to rely on a Stark exception or look to rely on the new Stark waivers, you want to make sure you've covered those bases as part of your contracting strategy. We've been asked in the compensation, around compensation, about the development of hazard pay premiums. More recently, I think if you're going to develop hazard pay premiums, you'll have to give some thought to the types of clinicians that would be eligible for hazard pay and develop some an approach around those hazard pay premium concepts. I think those could become more prevalent as these types of incremental arrangements will become more prevalent as the pandemic continues to spread and more providers are at risk of coming in contact with the virus. We could see the development of more of those hazard pay concepts. A couple other things to think about are billing and collection, payer credentialing. Most organizations we're working with will bill and collect under these arrangements. So the clinician would need to help them seek reimbursement. Actually, we've seen some organizations build in language around the clinician agreeing to provide documentation to help the organization seek aid from the new aid and funding programs that are being developed. Organizations are thinking about professional liability and what type of insurance coverage is going to apply. And then lastly, it's a rapidly developing consideration is the issuance of the new Stark waivers, and I know we're going to talk about this later as well, or we likely will, but it's important to think about how these types of arrangements are going to fit into the Stark waivers if you're going to rely upon them. If you're looking at these as new arrangements with a new provider, the analysis seems more straightforward. I would say that you likely could fit that arrangement within as the Stark waivers if they are they're going to clearly be tied to the COVID-19 coverage, and they likely would be entered into within the pandemic or the national emergency period, and likely would shut down at the end of the pandemic. And so that likely would fit within the current state of those waivers. I do think you would want to maintain documentation that you could show to CMS later, like you're required under the waivers, around the rationale and how these arrangements relate to COVID-19 and how they were terminated at the end of the emergency. I think it still is best to use a very simple document, like I mentioned earlier, if you can, so that you preserve the opportunity to rely on one of the Stark exceptions for purposes of compliance down the road. And it's always nice to have a template on standby for that situation as it occurs. So those are some legal considerations related to incremental arrangements, Tom.
No, that's great, Joe. And I obviously a lot to unpack there, right? And very unique to those types of arrangements. And I think, you know, you've outlined a wide array of considerations beyond just let's just paper this arrangement and get some folks in. you know, I think you really detail out a number of additional considerations that folks are going to have to think about, particularly as they're rushing to get some of these in place on what is likely a pretty truncated timeline. So pay, I mean, pay is always, you mentioned that, Joe, and you mentioned hazard pay premiums in terms of payment under some of these arrangements. Andrea, I'm curious, and you said your colleague's been helping with some of these as well, but you know, how are you approaching, you know, payment? I mean, is it really just payment for additional services? Are there premiums involved? Are people requesting those? You know, how are you seeing that play out as you're asked to value some of these more unique arrangements?
So in answer, maybe going back to your first question, I think the most common scenario for a request for incremental staffing right now anyway is around the ICU. And having additional coverage for the ICU, whether that be physician coverage or other providers. With respect to physician coverage, I think the question is, are you getting that physician coverage from an existing provider or an existing physician group that might have some capacity to provide some additional coverage, another person or longer shifts or something like that? And or are you going outside and getting it from another provider who normally you wouldn't contract with? In either case, I think that there are some interesting questions that we have come across related to whether the pay that an existing provider would get is going to be sufficient for the current, on an hourly basis anyway, for the current emergency, given that there's this potential exposure to disease, the conditions might be a little less desirable, for lack of a better term, than what folks might be used to. The patients that they're expecting in the ICU in the COVID-19 emergency have very acute needs, and so there's a higher level of intensity of services. There's question for some providers about the extent to which their liability insurance will cover them for anything that happens in the course of the care that they're providing. And given all of that, I think there's a recognition that the services that might be provided incrementally are extremely important, but they might have a different worth or value than just your ordinary course of care services. And so those are the types of questions that we're dealing with, in particular related to issues about liability insurance on exposure to disease, and what happens when you have an existing contract with a provider and you need to amend that contract or add additional staffing through a separate contract that might be with the same provider, and how you accommodate the fact that you have a way of doing things that you've stuck to up to now, but now have to make a transition to a new payment model to accommodate the emergency. So a lot of interesting questions, I think, on the incremental staffing side, and some of those overlap, as Joe mentioned, with the provider standby availability question. Do you staff incrementally for what you expect to be needed to make sure that you have everybody ready, or do you just have everybody sort of on call without any additional compensation and at the ready should they need to be activated? I think that's a question that a lot of folks are asking as well. Many of our clients are deferring to let's get people engaged, have them in the hospital, have them ready, because we're going to need them on an immediate basis, given the situation nationally, although I think it varies probably by region to some degree.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And I'd almost say that, you know, you're seeing the incremental staffing arrangement or even, you know, modifications to existing arrangements come into play kind of as that first option, whereas the standby and even the redeployment types of arrangements are the ones where you have a little bit more lead time to plan for. You know, one quick follow-up question for you, Andrea, and something you mentioned that I think we're beginning to see a little bit too here is, say you have an arrangement, an existing arrangement with a group or a physician, and I think you had articulated may contemplate a certain compensation structure, but now you're offering an hourly or another type of structure for the to treat pandemic patients or to accommodate the coverage that you need. In particular, where you're applying a premium, have you had the question or, you know, a concern raised around, well, hey, my normal course arrangement, I'm getting paid worse than I now am under my, you know, pandemic type arrangement. You know, what's up with that? I mean, are you getting that concern yet? Yeah, we've heard some rumblings of that, although we haven't had to deal with it directly yet.
So is the question whether providers who are brought in for incremental staffing are getting a different arrangement than those who are under existing arrangements, and whether that's creating a concern for parties who are under the existing arrangement? I think more often than not, folks are thinking about that issue. And I mean, this is sort of painting everything with a broad brush, but there's, I think, a recognition that the emergency is affecting everyone, including those who are continuing to provide care in the setting that they've always provided it, or in the time frame that they've always provided it. And so there is some adjustment to pay, I think, even for folks who are normally in the ICU and just might face more acute conditions now and might be facing a different set of circumstances than they would. I think there's an assumption, and at least that's something that underlies all of our analyses, that whatever premium is paid would only be for the duration of this emergency, and when the emergency conditions are over, compensation would go back to the normal level.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, and yeah, that's definitely responsive to the question. So let's maybe shift gears here to the second bucket of types of arrangements that we're seeing beyond just incremental staffing as it relates to existing and potential future arrangements, and that's the provider redeployment arrangement. So Joe, maybe talk to us a little bit about what one of those might look like, and maybe some of the more unique challenges, some of which we may have not talked about yet, that health systems and providers in some situations may face.
Thanks, Tom. And what we are seeing in some markets are the need to redeploy types of providers in anticipation, you know, for the surge. And as we talked about earlier, there's different levels of surge going on right now. But I think there is more broadly nationwide actually broad excess of capacity in certain specialties due to the pause that was put in place around procedures back in, I believe it was on March 19th. And partly because of that pause, we are seeing healthcare organizations look to engage that excess capacity for clinicians that have skills that are needed to be part of the COVID-19 response. That repurposing is one place we're seeing it, I would say, is more than others, is with anesthesia. They've experienced reduced procedures since that pause. Many anesthesia providers are being repurposed to help with intubations and airway management. This is actually going to be a critical skill are for COVID-19 patients, and is something that was experienced in China and Italy in their response. And I think we're seeing the same thing here with anesthesia and with some other specialties as healthcare organizations look to repurpose. I think some of the challenges here that we encounter when looking to develop a repurposed strategy and the arrangements are identifying the appropriate specialties, forecasting the need, and then adjusting the contracts. You know, for any specialty that can involve, often, you know, that's going to involve looking at their contracts and the compensation plans and the coverage capabilities. and then forecasting out the staffing and planning necessary to make sure you have the capabilities. And it is going to take a look, you're going to have to take a look at your different specialties on a specialty by specialty basis. You're going to have to look at those arrangements. And depending on the specialties, clinical capabilities, you know, they might be the right fit, but it could be more challenging aligning the underlying incentives. If I go back to the example to anesthesia, you know, many anesthesia providers are paid under a fixed type compensation model, often salary or hourly. Some have some type of productivity component on top of that. And if they have a productivity component, you might want to explore transitioning that model to more of a coverage model that accurately would reflect their work effort during the pandemic. And I think that's for any specialty. As you look at repurposing them, is the productivity model still the right fit? Do you want to try to incorporate these new services into the existing compensation model, or some way look at these as a new service and a new arrangement when you look at repurposing? When you do that transition, I think it's important to make sure that the new model and the new coverage accurately reflects their work effort during the pandemic. If they are paid hourly for that work, you know, potentially for anesthesia, especially, you could keep them in their current model and maybe adjust the model if they have an increasing work demand and coverage hours. But again, this is going to be really a service line by service line specific analysis that's dependent on your strategy as an organization and your COVID-19 response. We've seen organizations take the approach of looking to repurpose in order to build up capacity for other organizations. And I think we'll talk about this later as well, that are seeing reduced work and demand right now. They are taking other strategies where they're actually scaling back provider work and provider compensation as an alternative rather than repurposing. So I think in many ways, there's a lot of options on the table. But for organizations that need to develop and increase their capabilities and have the ability to repurpose some physicians, I think some of the concepts I just described are the efforts you'd have to take to make that work. Some last thoughts on this are also relate to, like we talked about before, with respect to the credentialing of these providers and ensuring they are appropriately credentialed internally. Make sure that you run down any issues with your malpractice coverage and the scope of services that these providers are performing. Make sure that the appropriate levels of cross-training are involved as necessary in oversight. If you have providers that are working in areas that they traditionally may not have worked at such high levels, you want to make sure you run down to make sure that there is an appropriate level of clinical capabilities when they're doing this kind of work. So those are some of the issues we're running down.
Yeah, no, those all make sense. Joe, I'm kind of curious, you know, on your thoughts, particularly where you have a hospital that's asking a provider who, again, doesn't have as much as or any experience in a certain specialty or line of work, and they're asking them to redeploy into that line of work and help with the cause. Do you see a lot of questions or requests from providers who hesitate and say, hey, can I limit liability? Can I get a release or a hold harmless or something? Because now I'm entering into waters at your request where, you know, in a pandemic where while I may have been cross-trained and I'm getting up to speed on things, I don't have the same level of expertise that I have in my normal specialty. Are you seeing any types of concerns expressed by providers there?
Yeah, I think most of the focus has been on the provider side of running down to make sure that the appropriate coverage is available for these providers and to make sure they're taking the steps they need to ensure that the credentialing is handled appropriately and that these individuals have appropriate privileges for the work they're doing. So I think that most of the focus has been on that end. With respect to the providers that are stepping up to help, I think organizations that I've been talking to are ensuring that they're extending the coverage necessary to protect those providers. I've not seen as much focus on the hold harmless from the clinicians at this point. You know, many of them to this point have been employed, and from an independent contractor standpoint, for arrangements involving independent contractors, even outside of the repurposing we're talking about, we have seen more comfort with ensuring that they fall under that coverage as well.
Right. No, that again makes a lot of sense and sounds like reasonable risk mitigation strategies are being deployed in those situations. So, Andrea, turning back to you, what if any or any kind of unique compensation type issues are you seeing as, again, these providers are venturing into new spaces where they haven't typically provided services?
So I think there are a lot of questions around the redeployment arrangements. We've already mentioned the concept of hazard pay, and that's certainly one that comes up in all of the compensation questions in all four of the categories that we're talking about. With redeployment, there are some questions about pay parity. If you're taking a neurosurgeon or an anesthesiologist whose normal compensation is at a fairly high level, given the nature of the services that they typically provide, and you're putting them in a different setting where it's not even clear the extent to which there would be billing and collections for their services, and the credentialing is still a sort of a hurdle you have to get past. Is the pay commensurate with what their typical pay is, and perhaps even subject to a premium for hazard and for other things, or is it going to be something less? And I think that really is driven by specific facts and circumstances. One of the other things that Joe brought up that I think influences a lot of the question and answer around the pay and other things is the level of liability that the physician might have, if any, is there going to be indemnification for the physician while they're providing atypical services? Does their insurance coverage apply, or will they need additional or alternative coverage? And is the hospital going to provide that, or is that something that they're responsible for on their own? So a lot of those questions are like these combined legal / compensation questions where counsel and folks like us will kind of work together to parse out the details and understand where the compensation should be on the scale. And I know Joe mentioned this, and we are jumping ahead a little bit because it was one of the topics that we were going to cover a little later, but with the Stark waivers, you know, there's a lot of discussion about how much leeway there is. And I think that there probably is some leeway, but I think there's also a recognition, at least among our clients, that folks just want guidance. They're not really even sure where to start in making the decisions. They want to make sound and reasoned decisions because not only are there legal risks, but there are also financial risks in everything that's going on. And having some understanding of where to start and what questions to ask and what's important to consider, I think is going to be really important for folks going forward with a lot of these novel types of arrangements, because we don't know how long this crisis is going to last, and we don't know what the eventual outcome is going to be financially from a public health perspective and so forth.
Yeah, and as you were making those comments, Andrew, and this, I think this could go to Joe or yourself, or maybe you both have some thoughts to give on this. As I look at, particularly again, our organization's position, we're primarily in Colorado and have operations and hospitals in Montana as well, and so we're just kind of getting to the point where we're seeing more patients in our facilities that are testing positive, and our resources are starting to get stretched. But we're certainly not in a New York or another type scenario where folks are really at their max, if not beyond their max, with what they're seeing. So as we just maybe to pause here for a second, as and I don't know if you've advised clients in some of these hot spots or these areas that are already well into their surge, is their thinking and their choice of the type of arrangement that we're looking here, is it, does it lean one way or the other? Do you see less discipline because they're under stress circumstances in how they're treating it? I'm just kind of curious to get your thoughts, particularly as you're advising clients maybe in one situation versus the other, and how they're approaching even a number of different things that we've discussed.
I wouldn't say that there's less discipline. I just think that the questions that they might be thinking of and the most pressing issues for them might be different. Mm. The situation is pretty fluid for most people or most hospitals. I think they're at different points on the spectrum as far as whether they're in the preparation or response mode. And I think as you progress from preparation or through preparation to response, the things that become important might shift a little bit. And so although I think everyone's kind of thinking about the big picture and there's a lot of similarities in the themes related to the type of question and the type of issue that folks are dealing with, where they are in the spectrum of preparation or response really, from my perspective, is dictating what it is that they're focusing on and where they're having to pivot. And in some cases, compensation becomes something on which they have to pivot even after they've made a decision a few weeks earlier, because the circumstances have just changed. The provider availability has changed. The needs of the patients have changed. The census has changed. The state of emergency has changed, whatever it is. Or some new fact has been learned about the ability to bill and collect, an assumption that you might have made about that early on is perhaps not valid anymore. And so the questions don't usually end after they're initially asked and answered. They may just evolve over time.
I think that is great perspective, Andrea, and it certainly aligns, I think, with a couple of things. First, our own experience, and second, just hearing your comments, the way you talked about from planning to responding, I think that's a very real thing. And just as you kind of went through some of your comments, really describes kind of the on the fly type of decisions and approaches people are supposed are taking under these circumstances. So no, great perspective. So let's maybe shift to the third type of arrangement that I think Joe, at least at the outset of the podcast, had alluded to some degree when he mentioned some of these pools that some clients are looking at establishing that are still maybe in that planning mode and have the luxury of kind of building up their resources. So maybe be it that one, Joe, or maybe some others, what does that arrangement look like? What are some others that you're seeing look like, and what are the challenges that are unique to those that you're seeing?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And I think, as you mentioned, and I mentioned earlier, that these arrangements, in my mind, are similar to the incremental staffing arrangements. The hope for all, I think, healthcare organizations is that these clinicians they're engaging in some type of a pool or standby arrangement will not be needed. The arrangements that I have worked on and the models that I've developed to date have only compensated physicians in the event that they're activated on an individual level. I think that I'd be interested to see if Andrea has explored standby type arrangements. I guess I would suppose if you have a larger professional services agreement with a group that that has some excess capacity and they're repurposed, in some ways they're a standby type arrangement. But in the individual models that I've worked on and templates that I've helped develop, they only pay the clinicians upon their actual activation. With these standby arrangements, I think that the legal issues and the legal challenges or become more complicated as you broaden the pool of standby providers you're looking to activate. I've had organizations that are looking to reach out to retired providers that are reaching out to some states that are waiving in providers in their final year of medical school. And so as you look to broaden that pool of providers and clinicians, you're going to have some different issues. Another pool of providers I've encountered is also volunteers. There's a significant number of clinicians that are volunteering to provide coverage in this way as well. So again, as you broaden the pool to these additional types of providers in different levels of retirement versus a medical student versus those that are licensed in other states. Many states have waived licensure, so you're going to see more and more of that, providers coming in from other states. That can build some additional complexity, especially around the need to credential these providers, especially around the need to talk to your malpractice carrier. Some of these clinicians are again, only going to be providing services when they're activated. And so it raises the question, where are they providing services when they're not activated? Are they performing services at another facility? How does that work from your malpractice carrier standpoint? It's likely your malpractice coverage would look to cover them while they are, performing clinical services within your facility. But as it becomes more fluid and they're providing services at more facilities, I think it gets a bit more challenging. So there's a lot of overlap here with the incremental arrangements we talked about earlier. I think that you could incorporate and use the same type of documentation for standby providers. As I mentioned, a very similar template type document. If you're going to use some type of a written agreement, you're going to need to step through many of the same questions that we talked about earlier around billing and collecting and credentialing and ensuring that you get them aligned on the professional liability from a professional liability standpoint, and thinking about an overall defensibility standpoint from a Stark standpoint and Stark compliance, I would follow a similar documentation approach as we talked about in the incremental piece. I'm interested to see if Andrea has other thoughts as well. One thing I alluded to earlier is, again, I haven't worked on a standby type concept where there's paid standby. I'm wondering if that will develop in the future. When we think of standby type arrangements, we're usually thinking about call coverage concepts in the current market, where we start to think about the physician's burden and some type of response time and their agreement to be available a certain amount of time. I imagine if we got into standby concepts, those would be some of the ideas we would be exploring as we developed a new contract. And so those are some thoughts on standby.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Joe, as you were saying that even another situation that could develop, and I'll be interested to hear Andrea's thoughts both on kind of, I think you articulated an activation fee type model and paying for them while even they're not even providing services, anticipating that they will, is, provider resources will become scarce at some point, right? At some point, you're going to start going through providers either because they get sick or you just don't have enough to provide coverage. So there may be more of an appetite in that type of situation to pay for them to be available, because if you don't lock them down, you could have them potentially go to either another facility in the local area, or we've seen calls from different geographic areas for providers from out of state to come in and help to some degree. So, but with that thought, I'll turn it over to Andrea to see if she's got some insight on maybe a couple of those compensation pieces that were mentioned.
So we are already seeing some payment activity for standby coverage. And as you point out, Joe, the concepts are kind of similar to call coverage. I think where it's coming into play, the idea of paying somebody for availability is in areas where there's already a shortage of providers, areas that might be remote and or rural, or might have recently experienced some other disaster, which has caused flight out of the area and meant that there's a limited supply of providers. And those areas that have already gone past preparation and are now in response and might have such a shortage that unless you have the provider kind of locked up, there's no guarantee that anyone's going to be available in the time frame that you need them to be available. So I think there are various circumstances under which even now there are payments for the standby availability, and those certainly make sense from our perspective. And they are analyzed somewhat similarly to call coverage in terms of the way the compensation might be paid. There's some additional factors that I think come into play with the COVID-19 emergency that are maybe outside the scope of what you would typically see in an on-call arrangement. One of them is the acuity of the patients that you would expect in a COVID situation where someone is called in. And going back to the concept that we discussed several times already, the hazard pay concept related to the fact that these providers, if they are called, will not only have to drop everything, but would potentially be exposed to an infectious disease. And they're putting themselves at personal risk in addition to financial risk and all the other factors that go into the idea that physicians should be paid for their on-call availability or other providers for that matter.
Yeah, no, I think those are all great points, Andrea, and I think they all kind of vary, kind of at least those latter ones in particular, unique factors to kind of how you're looking at that particular type of arrangement in that standby situation. So shifting gears again, maybe over to a question that I can't imagine you're not getting, and certainly one that I think is on the minds of both facilities and providers through all of this is the concept or the reality of lost income. I think I mentioned this earlier, just on the hospital side, we're having to cancel elective surgeries, having to clear space and take other measures that are, you know, causing lost income because they're being replaced with lower revenue generating type of care, but also because there's incremental expense with all the care that's being provided as part of the COVID-19 response, which all contributes to this lost income. And as you look at the CARES Act that was passed just in the last few days, there was a lot of funds made available to providers to tap into as part of that and other mechanisms that are being deployed. But you know, a lot of the providers in particular, and go back to that elective surgery, if you have a surgeon who had a bunch of scheduled cases, is on a productivity model type of contract, they're obviously going to be directly impacted, and there may be some mitigation that might come in an incremental staffing or redeployment situation. But, you know, by and large, they're going to face a drop in their income. So, Joe, I'm curious kind of how if these questions are coming up first, and then maybe how some of your client providers and facility clients are responding to those questions, requests, and concerns.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. We're getting a lot of these questions in the context, I think, of two major scenarios. One, employed providers for the employed providers, and the second is in the context of professional service agreements, where the financial arrangement is driven by productivity, and there has been or will be a decrease during the pandemic. On the employed side, and that lost compensation for the employed providers, you know, I think we recognize that many of them are that they are very critical to developing future patient care. In those contexts, they are all facts and circumstances driven. We have seen some healthcare organizations look to implement some type of protection under the individual physician productivity type models, whether in the form of some type of a short-term compensation floor, along with maybe a future look back that contemplates the future ramp up of any pent up demand once procedures begin. That's one thing to think about as you look at any type of compensation model in this context. Give some thought to whether some type of future reconciliation concept could be brought in the event that physician becomes productive again. So we are seeing that. We're seeing quarterly restarts under productivity models, where the physicians sometimes are held responsible under the annual model if they're underproductive in a certain quarter. And so we're seeing some development in this area. I think they are circumstances driven. Some organizations are letting the compensation models ride as they ride. Many have a base compensation already, and they have a productivity incentive when those levels are met, but they rely on the existing comp guarantee. Others recognize that many of these models trail, and because the collections and productivity trail out maybe a month or several months after, depending on how the organization calculates, they may not even be getting hit by this decreased productivity. So some of them are taking a cautious approach and waiting to see how the situation develops. Also, other organizations are repurposing these providers and having them provide services differently during the pandemic in order to take some pressure off the compensation models. In the PSA situation, we're seeing most of the activity here in hospital-based coverage arrangements where the formula includes some type of a productivity calculation. And I would say in those models, I would recommend, again, giving some thought to whether the model really is generating lost income or triggering reduced compensation already, because, again, it may be trailing. And if that is the case, there may not be an immediate need for action. Give some thought, like I mentioned before, about potential future reconciliations that may occur after the national emergency is over and after that pent-up demand. Give some thought also to around potential aid that may be received either by the contracting medical group or the healthcare organization through the ongoing government funding programs, and how that may fit into the model, and to see where risk should fall between the two contracting organizations. I've seen some scenarios, lastly, where in the context of all this, I mentioned some organizations are letting the comp models ride. Other organizations are recognizing that they just can't afford these compensation models in this context, and are actually looking to have some of these physicians take vacations or reduce their FTE status in order to ride out this period of time. So definitely a lot of activity here.
No, I would presume that's the case, and certainly will continue to be the case as time goes on, and particularly like your thoughts around the reconciliation provision, right? If this doesn't go on that long and people do too much on the front end and things catch up on the back end, certainly would help avoid putting folks in a tough spot there on the back end. And also like the ad around accounting for all the public funding and programs that may be available to assist. So great thoughts there. Andrea, I presume this has got to be a tough one to approach from a valuation side. So kind of interested in your thoughts as well as to how folks are looking at these on the compensation side of things.
Well, I'm going to echo the thoughts of Joe, or the remarks of Joe and you as well, that the situation is somewhat fluid with respect to physicians and other providers who might be seeing a downturn or whose services at the very moment might not be as in demand as they were previously. I'll echo Joe's comments about the fact that there are trailing collections. So those physicians may not start to feel the impact until closer to the end of this crisis. I think there's also the fact that demand might be pent up, and that's something to take into consideration. So while there is a moratorium on elective procedures right now, and folks may not be doing them, three or four or 5 months in the future, there might be just a deluge of those procedures with the pent up demand and rescheduled services. And so some of the payment questions might kind of come out in the wash. That being said, providers have to live today, and their services may still be needed, even though they're not needed in the same volume that they were before. Joe had mentioned anesthesia providers being redeployed. Well, anesthesia is probably one of those specialties where there is an impact due to the decline in elective procedures. But on the flip side, a hospital still definitely needs to have anesthesiologists available, and their skill set might be very useful, and you want to make sure it's available. I mean, there's a meme kind of going around on social media saying, folks would much rather be intubated by an anesthesiologist than a gynecologist. So to the extent that there is a shortage of providers, you want to make sure that those anesthesiologists are available. And it may be that you need to make sure that they have the appropriate resources to ensure that enough staff are available and during this crisis. And so that, I think, needs to be taken into consideration when you're thinking about the wait and see approach versus do we do something to make sure that compensation is appropriately addressed now.
No, great thoughts. It's particularly on the fluidity of it, Andrea. It's almost hard to answer that question with one or two responses because the situation continues to evolve. So certainly appreciate those perspectives. All right, so our last topic for the podcast today is around something I think, Joe, at least you've mentioned here a few times, and I know a lot of people are probably anxious to hear more about, and knowing we only receive these here Monday night, and so it's probably just predicting what may occur at this standpoint as folks digest this. But this pertains to the Stark waivers and how you may envision, maybe on your initial reads, Joe, that they may use in the different arrangements that we've discussed during the podcast today.
Great, thanks, Tom. In looking at the Stark waivers, one question, I would say, the Stark waivers have come out and healthcare organizations continue to react to their circumstances. And so in many ways, the questions themselves haven't changed, but we are getting asked more questions about how healthcare organization strategies fit in with the context of these new waivers. I do think that healthcare organizations are going to have to think about their compliance strategy throughout this and how it interacts with the waivers. The bottom line is that the waivers do have their limitations, and they do have a limitation of scope. And I'll touch on a few of these in a second. And it is important as you're making decisions throughout this process that you do think ahead to a year or 2 years from now, and the importance of it, having justification for the actions you're taking. You don't want to create compliance concerns. I know it's a very fluid environment, but it's really important to have your compliance strategy thought out. I think that's even more important because CMS said in these waivers that they're intended to be additional safeguards, and that you may be able to fit your current arrangements within an existing Stark exception. And if you can do that, I would do it that way. The waivers are new. They terminate at the end of the pandemic. So we generally just recommend that you look to them if you think it's absolutely necessary for your bona fide COVID-19 response. But do try to align your arrangements with an existing Stark exception. As I hit on earlier, for many of these arrangements, the waivers probably would never be necessary. And for example, if you use a short two-page agreement and sign that or sign a short amendment to your current agreement in writing and you pay an appropriate rate of compensation, then you're probably most of the way there towards meeting Stark compliance anyways. And it's unlikely you would have to even utilize these waivers. And that's what I would encourage you to do here. We've hit on a lot of contracting issues that are propping up in these different scenarios. And I think at least having something on paper is encouraged throughout this. If you want to do something more creative, and you're not sure if the creative approach you're taking, it falls within these waivers, and if you don't think it falls under a Stark exception, I would ask you to think about submitting your own hospital-specific 1135 waiver that covers your circumstances. The government is anticipating those right now. That would at least provide you some cover. If you look at the waiver document itself, it says that the arrangements that are subject to the waiver must be absent of the government's determination of fraud or abuse to fall under the Stark waivers. And I think that's the government's way of saying that, you know, they could find liability under anti-kickback or if there are abusive underlying facts here. And so I think that's why it's going to be really important for you to be able to show your arrangements were pursued for an appropriate COVID-19 purpose. The waivers already say that entities need to make their documentation available if they're going to rely on the waivers. So I would also say if you're going to look to the waivers, develop some approach for maintaining separate documentation for these types of arrangements. Look to probably develop a form that shows why the arrangement's purpose and scope it relates to the COVID-19 response that you've developed. You want to really show that nexus. If you can build it into the agreement that you're developing, I think that's even better. I would keep some documentation showing the rationale for the compensation model, some confirmation that the arrangement started and ended during the time period that the national emergency was in place, that the waivers are set up to terminate upon the expiration or termination of the declared public health emergency. So they're going to end. And so I think that's one reason why I think trying to get in line with a Stark exception is the best approach, because then if you're in that arrangement after the national emergency ends, you can still rely on it. You're not going to have the same issues. And it also is going to ensure that you don't have a compliance gap throughout this. So I don't think the Stark waivers are a free pass. If you do look at them, it's good that the government gave some examples of arrangements they thought would fall under the waiver. Again, as I mentioned earlier, if you're going to enter into a brand new clean arrangement that's clearly related to the COVID-19 purpose, I think it's going to be easier to rely on the waivers. If you have existing arrangements and you're looking to rely on the waivers in conjunction with that new arrangement and you or that existing arrangement, and you know that existing arrangement's going to continue after the pandemic's over, it's going to be a little messier. And I do think you should give more thought to how the waivers fit into your overall compliance strategy. So the waivers were very welcome. It was good they were retroactive back to March 1st and will carry us through the pandemic. I would look to them if necessary for your overall strategy, but also try to contract in line with Stark as it exists today.
Those are great insights, Joe. I think everyone gets very excited when they hear Stark waivers, but I think that's very grounding and thoughtful advice in the sense that, you know, you could see them come into play in certain unique circumstances. And I think it was helpful that CMS or that they did outline, you know, a number of scenarios where they could be used to kind of focus people, but definitely good advice that they will, you know, that they should, that the normal course Stark exceptions should be considered before using those. Andrea, I can't imagine you're not receiving some when people see that they can pay above or less than fair market value, those types of things aren't hitting your email yet. So curious to hear if you are getting any requests or have thought through how you might want to approach some of those types of arrangements that CMS outlined in its guidance.
So we're kind of reacting as well as everyone else. And I, you know, the thing that has struck me is the number of folks who are just looking for guidance, in part because
like I said earlier, they just don't know where to start. And then thinking back to my days as counsel in another life and dealing with the aftermath of hurricanes and other emergencies where the whole world, it seems, had gone upside down, and there were all kinds of requests for arrangements that just were outside the norm and something I wasn't familiar with. And thinking about the fact that, you know, one or two laws might not apply, there's this whole universe of other risk that was going through my mind at the time, from, you know, state laws to local ordinances to what does this look like from a business perspective and what does this mean financially and what is this going to mean in 3 months, in 6 months, in 12 months when somebody's looking back at what we did. And there, I think having a partner like us, and I was a client at the time, it's great. You know, it's somebody to kind of bounce ideas off of and to get an opinion on and to put things in perspective so that you can have a reasoned, logical approach to answering the type of question that you've never seen before or that is different in some way from all the other things that you've seen and in a way that is making you kind of scratch your head. I think it would help me sleep better at night, and I imagine that's maybe how some of our clients are feeling as well. You know, we've heard many people point out Stark Law waivers don't apply with respect to the statute. They don't apply with respect to state laws. You have nonprofits that are still kind of concerned about their tenuous position. And so I think there's a lot to think about.
No, absolutely. Definitely more than meets the eye with those, notwithstanding, again, all the excitement that one might think or feel when initially thinking about what opportunities they could provide. Well, I think that concludes our, at least the substantive portion of our podcast today. Joe, Andrea, it was a pleasure to kind of be between the two of you here asking some questions, and thank you for all the great perspective and discussion today. And with that, I will turn it back over to Andrea to close us out.
Tom, I thank you, and I thank Joe for participating. And as I said, this was intended to be part one, and we will hopefully be soon having a second discussion, part two, that will focus on supplies and space and equipment and some of the challenges around that. And thank you all for joining us today.